Earlier this morning, I called the Prime Minister to advise him that it was my judgment that the majority of the party room no longer supported his leadership.
What began as a minority has, by a process of intimidation, persuaded people that the only way to stop the insurgency is to give in to it.
Are you running for leader, Joy? Is it time to end this farce, Foreign Minister?
We have the numbers, Mr. Dutton.
Prime Minister.
Are you the next Prime Minister, Scott Morrison?
Good afternoon. As you're all aware, there was a ballot conducted in the party room for the leadership of the Liberal Party. The successful candidate was Scott Morrison, and he won this vote by 45 votes to 40 for Peter Dutton.
Hello.
Hello.
Could you tell me who you are and where we're going?
I am Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia and the host of your show. And right now we're walking at speed to the Prime Minister's courtyard, which is at the back of the back of Parliament House. We're going to see Malcolm Turnbull say goodbye. This courtyard at the back of Parliament House is drafty. It's exposed. The wind sort of howls through here in the wintertime, and basically it's been the scene for the execution of all of the Prime Ministers over the last decade of leadership turmoil. We said goodbye to Kevin Rudd here, we said goodbye to Julia Gillard here, we said goodbye to Tony Abbott here, and we're about to say goodbye to Malcolm Turnbull here. Here he comes.
I remain very optimistic and positive about our nation's future. And I want to thank the Australian people for the support they've given me and my government over the last nearly 3 years.
What a way to end a week. We've taken refuge in the pod cave, dealing with the end of another Prime Minister, all the drama of the last 7 days. I'm in the pod cave with Miles Martignoni, my producer.
Hello.
The best news ever.
Oh, it's lovely to come down here.
We get to do an episode together.
Yeah.
It's the best.
Yeah. I have so many questions. I mean, first of all, you know, you've lived and breathed politics and Canberra for so long. You've actually watched three prime ministers in that courtyard before today.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like watching a fourth go down in this way?
Well, it's really been interesting this week, I think, because there has been a sort of madness associated with this particular leadership contest that is different to some of the previous leadership contests. It's a bit hard to explain why, but there has been a level of madness associated with this that I've not seen before.
Is it because it's happened multiple times before and you would have thought that it might have stopped?
Well, this is the thing. I think part of the thing that existed or coexisted with madness this week was this sense of exhaustion in the parliament. It was sort of like this fine grain of sediment kind of settled over the joint, where people knew we were heading into another period of barking mad horror, were somehow powerless to stop it. But there was, instead of in previous leadership challenges where there has been almost a sense of drama and moment and stakes and all of this sort of stuff, this one, there was just this dreadful exhaustion, and that changed the dynamic of this contest versus ones I've seen previously. And in terms of standing in that courtyard, witnessing this again, as a journalist, as a citizen, as somebody who works their butt off to try and contribute to political discussion in some shape or form, I feel deep sadness. I feel really profound exhaustion myself that whatever we do as reporters, trying to focus on truth, trying to keep things steady in a media maelstrom, all of those contributions don't change how the story ends. And I think the political protagonists also felt some of that this week, that once again, they were in the same old play and it was going to rumble to its horrible end, but no one could sort of intervene to stop the trajectory?
Well, because it seemed like from the outside, from someone who isn't steeped in, you know, political manoeuvring, it seemed like Turnbull really tried a few gutsy moves, like trying to call the spill early, asking for the names, kind of giving ScoMo extra time to deal with things. Like it seemed like there was all this stuff happening, but it still didn't seem to really change a lot.
No. Well, I think Malcolm Turnbull made a decision at some point this week, I think probably on Wednesday, that there was no getting out alive, that it just was going to end badly. And I think what he decided to do is fight. And we haven't seen Malcolm Turnbull do enough of that in his prime ministership. Now, he explained to us today, Miles, you were in the courtyard with me, you heard, he explained to us today when Laura Tingle asked him the question, should you have fought your enemies more? Should you have stood up more? His answer to that question was, well, I learned from my experiences in 2009 when I stood up and they tore me out of the job. And what I was determined to do this time in the prime ministership was be a force for bringing the disparate elements of the party together. And that meant making a lot of compromises. When I think the prime minister came to on Wednesday and worked out that there was no way out alive, I think he determined to shrug off the disposition of his prime ministership and revert to type. And I think what we saw was fight. Malcolm Turnbull installing Peter Dutton's momentum, which was his objective. His objective was to stall Peter Dutton's momentum and try and allow someone other than him, either Julie Bishop or Scott Morrison, to come through and prevail in a leadership ballot. He needed to play for time. He needed to make it as difficult as humanly possible for the challengers to execute their coup. And he did both of those things. He also, Frank Underwood style, you know, there's that House of Cards, Frank Underwoodism, but if you don't like how the table's set, turn it over. Well, the Prime Minister also turned over the table by announcing casually that he would leave the Parliament at the conclusion of this leadership battle. All of those things, I think, were material in giving Scott Morrison time to gather numbers, in giving MPs pause for thought about the consequences of their actions. So I think it made a material difference, just not for him. Mm.
And so I guess when that moment when I found out Scott Morrison was going to be our new Prime Minister, I kind of didn't feel excited or shocked or happy or angry. It just kind of felt like, what was the point of it?
Well, you and the rest of the country. I mean, this will be for you know, for people like me who sadly live every waking hour of this crap, excuse us, everybody. Of course, I understand how Morrison came to be standing at the podium somewhat stupendously announcing that we had another new prime minister. I understand how that happened. For people going about their ordinary lives who are not at all interested in politics, who have vaguely tuned in and vaguely understand that something again is off the rails in Canberra, they will look up this evening at their TV news or on Facebook or wherever they get their information. They will see this guy and most of them will say, who the hell is that? That will be their first response. And that's, in a way, that's one of Morrison's biggest problems. He's come through the middle because he is viewed as a person who can straddle the disparate groups in the Liberal Party. He started out, when he arrived in Canberra as a politician, he started out as a moderate. During his time in Canberra, he's drifted in the direction of the Conservatives in terms of who he rolls with in the party structure. But he's not sort of any particular group. So I think their choice, Liberal Party MP's choice, really, was Peter Dutton, who was going to take the party in a very, very obvious Trump-esque direction, or Scott Morrison, who will also be slightly Trump-esque, I suspect, less so than Dutton, but a person who can manage the internal dynamics. I think the sort of resignation was, well, look, if anyone can, it's the guy who straddles both the groups. Also important, and something that will be completely, just a shock to people who don't follow politics and who may not recognise Josh Frydenberg, his deputy, who also showed up today, replacing Julie Bishop. Josh Frydenberg is a little bit like Morrison. He's socially liberal, but he kind of rolls with conservatives in terms of his power structure in the Liberal Party. He is serially affable, Josh Frydenberg. He is a serial enthusiast for people, for life, for adventure, for power, for the works. And as a consequence, has a lot of very, personal relationships with other people in the Liberal Party. He's a pack animal. He is never happier than when he is surrounded by people and activity. And so again, I think the sort of Morrison-Frydenberg ticket, insofar as we think the Liberal Party is still functioning and engaging its brain, is an attempt to have two people who can straddle the disparate groups, one of them more personable than the other. And it's going to be put the sticky tape around the show, cross your fingers, hope for the best.
For an everyday person.
Yeah.
What is this going to change? Not having Malcolm Turnbull, having ScoMo and having Frydenberg in.
How's it going to be different?
Yeah, how's it going to be different? Because you've talked about how there's all these political nuances that they're bringing the party together. But what does that change to someone like me?
Well, that remains to be seen. Genuinely, it does remain to be seen. Certainly, Morrison is a less progressive person than Malcolm Turnbull, demonstrably so, obviously so, and will project so. So Malcolm Turnbull, always a bit of a stranger in the Liberal Party, is gone. We've got a more conventional John Howard-style Liberal, conservative guy, basically, running the country. So I think the discourse will default to stock standard conservative John Howard style guy running the country. So that's how things will be different.
I really like that comparison to John Howard because it does make a lot of sense. You know, when he did his speech, he talked a lot about, you know, small business and, you know, people shouldn't have welfare. They should have jobs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. we should put power prices down, which mm-hmm. seemed like the kinds of things John Howard might have said as well. Mm. Can you decode Morrison's speech? What did he actually mean when he said all that stuff?
Okay. Well, he had a couple of objectives when he came out today. The first was, I didn't do this coup. It wasn't me. It was those other dudes. I've just come up through the middle, Stephen Bradbury style, and taken the prime ministership. So I didn't knife that guy, right? Objective one, I didn't knife that guy. Objective two, implicit apology to the Australian voters. Look, I know we've been running around like a lot of arse clowns for the last 2 weeks, says Scott Morrison in different words to me, but we've finished doing that now. And we remember that you're still out there and we're totally in your corner, whatever that means, right? So that was objective two, right? That we haven't forgotten, one, I didn't kill that bloke. Two, I haven't forgotten that you, the voters, are out there. Then there were some general words about framing what sort of a guy our new prime minister is, which is, you know, the little anecdotes about people going home to their families and having quality time, small business drivers, all of that kind of classic Liberal Party language, suburban guy Liberal Party language, right? Morrison kind of broke out the magazine or strapped on the magazine of suburban Liberal Party guy language, boom, out to the electorate. And it was sort of folksy, a bit homily, sort of, you know, I get you because I'm one of you, this sort of shtick. One thing about Morrison that is genuinely interesting, this guy does think a lot about how you sort of break through the resistance between politicians and voters right at the moment in a communications sense. He really does think about that. A lot of them don't. Morrison does think about, or his standing start is voters aren't listening, they think we're shits, and they don't care. So he experiments with his own communication to try and come up with folksy cut-through language that he thinks might resonate with people. right? He sort of puts a lot of effort into that. Some of it, frankly, is not that great. Maybe he'll get better at it. I don't know. But it's an interesting impulse. He gets it. He gets that he has to try and make connections with people. He doesn't sort of approach politics as a preaching exercise, which some politicians do. But he's going to have, look, he's our live social experiment. We're going to watch this guy, you know, work out whether he's up to being prime minister in real time in front of us over what the period that remains between now and the election. And it will, I promise you, listening at home who think that it might be time to just, you know, sort of pull out the plug from Canberra altogether and go surfing for the remainder of your life, that will be moderately interesting, watching whether or not this guy is up to it, whether this guy can rise to the occasion.
Something I didn't expect was for him to come out so strongly about needing to help our farmers.
Oh, yes.
Like, he made a big point of that. Now, is that because no one wants to be mean to a farmer? Like,
No, darling. Riddle me this. Where is the government at the moment weakest?
Queensland?
In Queensland?
Yeah.
And in?
Western Australia, maybe?
Yes, and in not a state.
The country?
Regional areas. Where is One Nation strongest?
Those same places.
Uh-huh. So there was a very immediate signal on the part of Morrison to the regions, which is where the government has been going out backwards in terms of support. It's where the real political insurgency in Australia is currently happening. This is where the independents are rising, where One Nation is rising, where politicians on the populist right of Australian politics are flourishing. So Morrison's immediate pitch was to the regions. I know you're there. I know you're suffering. I'm not going to, you know, give you a lecture, as Malcolm Turnbull did, I think, last week, completely inadvertently about, you know, well, Lucy and I de-stocked the farm before the drought, you know. Morrison is not going to approach things in that way. I mean, it may be not very effective in the way, but it won't be in that way, right? So I think that signal was quite important. Straight to the regions. We understand that you guys are suffering. We understand that you are cranky as hell at us. We get it. We're coming. We're going to sort something out for you. And that's about the beginning of Morrison trying to work out a language of connecting to voters who are departing from the Liberal and National parties.
I guess there's one big obvious thing here, because Morrison is talking all about unifying the party and I didn't do it and we're all friends now. But are they friends? Because it seems like the people who really, you know, they were walking around telling us, oh, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. They didn't seem to get what they wanted.
Yeah.
So do you think they're going to be quiet until the election at least, or are we going to keep hearing more from them?
I think it is very, very hard for the politicians who went through the events of the past fortnight to recover from them. I just think that's basic human nature. They can smile at one another and make small talk and pretend they're all friends again. But basically these leadership contests inflict deep, lasting wounds and post-traumatic stress on people that resonates well after they've gone. So no, of course they're not going to be real friends again. That's impossible. There is an element of the conservative wing of the Liberal Party that launched a full-scale takeover of the Liberal Party over the past fortnight. That was their objective. Their objective was not to make peace. Their objective was not to win friends. Their objective was not to create a diplomatic détente. That Dutton insurgency was about taking over the Liberal Party and blasting out people with alternate views. And that has broken cover. This dynamic that has been underway in the Liberal Party now for at least 3 or 4 years has now broken cover and is in full public view. No one is going to forget that. No one is going to forgive that. No one is going to think that the leopard suddenly changes their spots. But I think it is possible, if Morrison can stabilise the show relatively quickly, do a reshuffle that doesn't make thousands of enemies, put a coherent one foot in front of the other strategy together over the next couple of months, try and calm things down, that we will start to see a bit of a departure in the jihad camp, We'll see people who are hardcore terrorists continuing their hardcore terror activities because that's who they are and it's all they know and they will never do anything different. Then we will see another group prepared, I think, to sue for peace at least between now and the election because they have at least achieved a principal objective, which was dragging Malcolm Turnbull out of the building. There are elements of the Liberal Party that are hostile to Turnbull, have always been hostile to Turnbull, and would not rest until he was gone. So a major irritant, like a big burr in their foot, has been removed. Whether or not then they can calm themselves down for a few months and to give Morrison 5 minutes of peace, see if he can establish themselves himself, see if they can recover. I think we will see a parting in of the ways in between the two groups if Morrison doesn't screw it up.
So I texted my partner if she had any questions, and her question was, when is the election going to be? Because I want to go on holiday at some point.
well, your partner and the rest of us and the rest of the country. I think the simple answer is the election will be as far away as Scott Morrison can push it, like as far away into the future as he could possibly push it, because the Liberal Party right now is not even close to being battle ready, not even close, not enough money, not enough strategy, not enough organisational strength. So as far away as he can push it, he'll push it. But again, events may take this out of his hands. Malcolm Turnbull's forcing a by-election on them. The crossbenchers are looking at him like, not so sure about you, sunshine. There's a few moving parts that might take things out of Morrison's hands. But if he's left to his own devices later, if events intervene, sooner.
And I guess it's very easy to jump into what happens next. But it's very easy to forget that on Friday, a prime minister was deposed, essentially. So, you know, I'm wondering, what do you think Turnbull's legacy has been in the parliament?
Well, that's difficult. That's genuinely difficult. Because the hard truth of that is not much. I think his legacy has been a period as Prime Minister of trying to accommodate, which has been almost singularly focused on trying to accommodate the warring elements in the Liberal Party. And as a consequence of those dynamics, he's not been able to achieve much. And the things he has been able to achieve, it was interesting that he pointed to the legalisation of same-sex marriage, which did occur under his Prime Ministership, and the Liberal Party had to put us through their dreadful means of resolving that issue, and Malcolm Turnbull was powerful to stop the plebiscite being inflicted on the public. There was nothing he could do that had to be inflicted on the public, but he did achieve that result. And he, Malcolm Turnbull, as a person, I think, will be very happy with that, will be really proud and happy with that. Beyond that, he invested an enormous amount of energy in trying to get a coherent climate and energy policy resolved. That fight has spanned, you know, now two terms of his prime ministership, and it went down in flames. I think he was really focused on that being a core element of his legacy, that he could somehow thread that needle. The issue that had cost him the leadership of the Liberal Party in 2009, that somehow he could rerun that argument and it would have a different ending. Well, the Liberal Party told him, you can rerun that argument, mate, but it will not have a different ending. So he's been denied that element of his legacy. I don't think he was a terrible Prime Minister. I don't. I think he was a highly able person, but in quite difficult circumstances, both in general. I think his comment about it's hard to be a prime minister right now is absolutely true. I also think that there were a group of people in his government who were absolutely committed to seeing him achieve as little as humanly possible, and that's very difficult. But he's not without blame either. He could have made different choices. He could have fought when he conceded. He could have fought and he didn't. One of the striking things about Malcolm Turnbull as a politician is his lack of well, emotional intelligence is a stupid thing to say because he's quite an emotional person, but he doesn't have good instincts about people. He doesn't have – the best politicians have this kind of sixth sense about people, about rooms, about how you work a room, about how you strike a deal in a herd sport, which is politics. Malcolm Turnbull has exhibited none of those instincts. His political judgment has not been great, and his instinct about, you know, how you deal with the herd has also not been great, and it hasn't helped him. So it's a mixed picture. The thing about Malcolm Turnbull is that he is an uber-rational person. He always assumes rationality. He's confused when he encounters something that he considers irrational. And politics fundamentally is an irrational business. So we've seen a prime minister who has been a fish out of water in politics. First one in my reporting lifetime. Quite fascinating.
What do you think the dynamic is going to be with Bill Shorten and Scott Morrison now? Like, what's that contest going to look like?
Oh, what an interesting thought. I haven't got around to thinking about that yet. How's that going to be? It's obviously a different contest to Turnbull, and I think how that contest manifests will depend on a couple of things. Where Bill Shorten's been very advantaged in his contest with Malcolm Turnbull is that stuff we were just talking about Turnbull's lack of political judgment and instincts. Bill Shorten is all instinct. He is like the archetype of the politician that I'm talking about. Understands an institution, understands a herd, has sight in dark rooms, has those instincts, right? So it depends really on Morrison's instincts, how sharp they are and how good he is in response to events, which is really what makes or breaks prime ministers. That's how they respond to events is like 90% of whether their prime ministership succeeds or fails. We haven't seen enough of Morrison at the front of the queue to determine how good his political instincts are. So it's a fascinating question you ask. I haven't got an immediate answer for you, but we're going to find out over the next little bit.
And we should do a little wrap-up.
Like, yes.
Hey, you've been listening.
Oh, okay. Do you want me to do that? Thing?
Or, well, we could tag team it.
Okay.
What do we say?
I don't know. You've been listening again to Australian Politics Live. Thank you so much for listening. We really, really, really 100% do appreciate it. Do not forget to...
Subscribe. And I know the platforms. You know, you can do it on Apple Podcasts.
Because I always say, like, you know, subscribe however you... What do I normally say?
Subscribe wherever you can, which I think is because there's so many different apps and things now.
Do the apps.
So, you know, you could subscribe on Google Podcasts. No, that's not a real app. You could subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
You don't know the apps either.
I know some of the apps. Like, I use Pocket Cast on Android, but there's lots of other apps as well. Like, things are, yeah, the ecosystem. Why am I going on about this? I need to cut this out.
no, it's actually superb. So you can subscribe on those apps that Miles decanted from his head eventually.
Yeah.
Thank you so much to Miles, as always, who is the producer of this podcast series and without whom this podcast series would not happen. Bless his little cotton socks.
Always my pleasure, Catherine.
And we'll be back next week.
Yeah.
See what happens.
Who knows? Anything could happen.